This is Anne DeVore, a exercise in courage for women only, and that's January 16th, 1993. Tape one of...
raised me to do anything I wanted, and it didn't occur to me that there were women who didn't know they could have their own money. So when we were working in the Women's Center in Boulder, Colorado, which you would have thought was a very liberal town, you can't imagine the same accusation, I am sure, that they launched against Maud Gonne for turning the women into hysterical harpies was launched against our Women's Center, because the women wanted to know about money. They wanted to know about what the will looked like. They wanted to know what was going to happen if they didn't have, you know, someone to take care of them. I mean, that was the condition that the women's movement started with. And then, as you know, by 74, it was a very different thing. But it was interesting, and I loved those days. So, I know we're a big group today, but I still like to know at least first names and what you hope to get from a day like this. So if that's all right with you, we'll take the time to do it, because it helps me.
My name is Ananda. I can recall words and not exactly, but this is why I am.
Mm-hmm. The will, courage,
yes.
Pity, and
high.
Humility.
Right.
All right.
All
of those. Okay.
Yes. Thank you. And I think that I have a position to do.
The will. Wonderful. Well, there are two things we want to accomplish today, and one of the things that's very important to understand Celtic thought is their belief in the other world, where all of these ideas are originated. And the reason I asked for art supplies and drawing to bring something to work with today is I would like you to draw all day long, no matter what else is going on, so that you don't take down the words so much as images. The important thing about creative work is we have to take the image when it comes to us. And so you've got to be able to do what we call spontaneous drawings, or spontaneous poetry, or spontaneous doodling, or spontaneous word lists. And these are some of the habits that Yeats and Maud and the people of the Golden Dawn practiced in order to build a mind that could contain attention to the world as well as a listening in a vertical direction to their guidance at all times. The voice was always with Maud. She always heard the knowing voice as well as the here and now voice. So it's a good experience to take your art supplies and pen and paper, and I brought plenty of big paper, so the first step is for everybody to get something that they can write on, and help yourself to my stuff, because that's fine. They basically were looking for universal knowledge. And what I have discovered through the years of reading religious materials is that the virtues, as we would call the will or courage or pity or humility, are examples of what we would call universal knowledge. They are qualities which seem cross-culturally to be an aspect of the wisdom ray. to follow one's own wisdom requires a certain amount of will. And to follow one's own will requires a certain amount of courage. And to follow with your will and courage intact, you certainly have got to have a place to apply it that is of charitable importance. Because one of the first things that happens in the development of will and courage is what a Jungian might call an inflation and a potential for the misuse of power. And so pity is the term that Yeats used, and it was coincidental with the term that Joan of Arc used, and it was seemed to me the appropriate word. But another word for it is charity. And, of course, what happens in initiation is that one loses one's ego identity and one becomes an instrument for the energies of the self. That is, you are made humble. The ego is humbled before the needs or the desires or in serving the self. And until that happens and you are acknowledging that you are an instrument or a vehicle for either wisdom or energy or the carrier of a great gift or simply an instrument for the good, you have not yet received humility. So this isn't about denigrating oneself. This is really about bowing to a higher authority, which only you will know, which is why you must be connected to your own source. The magic of it all has not to do with sword and sorcery as much as it has to do with the word intention. Any magical act is an intentional act. So we do magic every day by following our intentions. If you set a goal and you follow through, you are practicing magic. What magic really has to do with is the command of the elements, earth, air, fire, and water, which is the basic units of all life. So when you set a goal and you devise the means to the goal, not only are you practicing magic, you are setting what we call the motion for the next goal and the next goal. In astrological terms, this is the sign of Sagittarius, the archer. I see this goal, and then I see that goal, and then I see the next goal. And they're all important. What I'm going to do is pass tarot cards as I remind you of some of the words of the lecture, just to give you an image to work with. And the reason that the tarot cards are important is that Maud Gonn and Yeats, many, many people in the Victorian times and the Art Nouveau and Art Deco circles were very involved in the tarot. They used it for clairvoyance. They used it to make decisions. They used it to center themselves as a meditation device. So our present time interest in tarot and dreams, the renaissance of it, really began with William Blake, who was, in fact, you could say, Yeats's mentor. I mean, Blake was dead, but Yeats believed that in his early life he was going to continue a certain aspect of William Blake's work. Maud was going to continue a certain aspect of the gods and goddesses of Ireland, the people of the Sidhe. It was her work that was the balancing. She was a balancer. One of the things that I had to struggle with all of my life was, you know, why is there so much chaos and evil. Why are people so constantly embattled and struggling? And, you know, when would it end? And I think what I've come to understand is that it really wouldn't matter if we could be magically transported into the fifth dimension or to another planet. The struggle goes on because it's all about a balancing. And you are either part of the problem or you are part of the solution. And so the personal battle is to become part of the solution and to stop being part of the problem. So another aspect of intention is to know when you're part of the problem and when you're part of the solution. And that is helped by knowing yourself, what the self wants for you. So I'll pass around the first card, which is the Chariot, and I'll remind you very briefly of what we said about the will. Notice that the Chariot has a canopy and four pillars of the universe, and it's completely contained in a lotus position with one big chakra. This is a totally unified being, and it's drawn by various mythological creatures which he controls with his mind. There are no reins. So this is the subduing of the four forces, earth, air, fire, and water, with the mind. So when you enter a Celtic world, think about their oral tradition, which survived throughout history. Think of the mind development that it took to become a poet or a bard. This is a mind-oriented culture. All of their goddesses were wisdom goddesses. They had no love goddesses. All of their goddesses had to do with direct knowledge, healing knowledge, warriors' knowledge, the training of young warriors. And this is all in mythological proportions. It's not about war, as Yeats came to understand, but it's about the struggle to overcome the chaos.
When you say mind, you don't mean simply intellect.
No, it has nothing to do with intellect. It's about wisdom and knowing, direct knowledge.
Dreams.
Think of the Celtic people as dream-oriented. Everything had to do with prophecy, dreams, omens. They did auguries for everything. They had a druid class that was strictly prophet. And they were called augurers. And they did everything from throw chickens up in the air to see which side of the fence the chicken was going to fly to. They did everything you can imagine. They tried everything. They had Brehons, who were justifiers, justice-oriented people, the legal people like Madgon. They had authority figures that were working closely to the king to keep the law intact. And they had the bards, who were solitary beings. And they had the priests, who were in charge of all the important celebrations. And the whole of Celtic life had to do with the cycles of the sun and the moon. So all of this is what Yeats and Maud and the group around them wanted to revive, is a life led by these cycles.
Yeah.
Well, the love is charity. But no love,
no error.
We don't have in this tradition an Aphrodite who is a sexual goddess. They had plenty of eros, but the point of their center had to do with right use of action and will, and it had to be led by charity. And the humility, because the king, as you know, marched out into battle with the men right in line. There was no protection of the king in battle. And there was no protection of the queen should she decide to go to battle. One of the great Celtic myths is about Cuchulainn and Ymir. And Cuchulainn had at his side his queen as he rode into battle. She drove the chariot. And when he lay wounded over the side of the chariot, she took up the bow. And they called her his wild-haired queen, screaming. And she came at the enemy as though she were a man. And you remember Boadicea, she burned cities to get rid of the Romans. She survived her rape and the rape of her four daughters, and it inflamed her to the point that she could lead peasants into war. So these are very interesting women. These are not your ordinary love goddesses. I would imagine that they're very lovable.
So what were waged to protect Ireland?
Always the wars were waged to protect Ireland. Invader after invader after invader.
Okay.
Yeah. That's right. Right. Ireland representing your center. So the war on the earth, as above, so below. The below might look like a real battle, but as Yeats would say, the real battle is the struggle in our minds. So when you look at a war in Ireland, you would have to find out what the motive was and what the prophecies were that would lead them into an actual war. But in fact, there was always a balancing going on in their very mental world. So this is will, and I'll pass it. Jung wrote that the will is nothing more than the energy that the ego has at its disposal to carry out the directives of the self. The will is nothing more than the energy that the ego has at its disposal to carry out the directives of the self. That sounds as though it's not very important, but when you consider that all of Jung's writing had to do with getting the ego strong enough to bear the onslaught of the self, you begin to realize that it would take a fairly strong and then humbled ego to do this. Because if your ego is in charge, there is in fact no will to carry out the directives of the self. If your ego is intact and humble, i.e. willing to step aside, there should be plenty of energy for the work of the self to be accomplished. And Maud, as we have witnessed, had a strong will aligned with the archetype the Irish people called the old woman, or Kathleen. As a young child, her dreams were haunted by an old woman on a windswept road, dressed in gray, beckoning her. Yeats captured that archetype in his first play, The Countess Kathleen, and later in Kathleen na Houlihan. Maud was Kathleen, and she set aside a personal life for the sake of the vision of freedom for the people of Ireland and for humane treatment of prisoners, women and children. And it was her father, Tommy, who had spoken to Maud about the strange force of the indomitable will. So in magic, the first element, we should say, is the development of will. And to do that, you have got to know what the right use of will would be. You have to examine your motives to find out what your will is. And you have a very strong sense with a woman like Maud that she truly believed in what she was doing. There is no question in her mind from the age of 7 that she was doing exactly the right thing. The second virtue of this woman is courage. And this is represented by the Emperor card. We could call it a strong animus, but as we saw in her, the archetype that led her was really a woman, a very strong woman. And so this is where you can't look at gender, but you have got to look at the power that's carried in an archetype. And for the Celts, it would not be unusual for that power to be carried in a woman's figure, like the queen or Kathleen. So we're not talking about gender. We're talking about the emperor force that is carried by these wisdom goddesses of Ireland. The courage to go where one needs to go would be the second element that you need once you know your will. Sometimes we know our will, but we aren't really sure that we can get where we need to go, and we hesitate. Campbell tells us that a hero enters a sacred space wherein there are many trials, tests, dangerous passages, and that though many enter, few succeed. Great courage is required to both begin and to continue on the path. Maud entered that space when she visited Portland Prison in 1889, and the knowing was upon her, a knowing that allowed her to speak the date of release for each prisoner. She herself was imprisoned and maligned and misunderstood. For the sake of the work, and for the sake of her son Sean's future, and for the sake of Ireland, she never attempted to explain her actions during the midlife troubles with John McBride and her subsequent divorce. If it were not for Yeats and his penchant to record every move Maud ever made, we would not be able to see so clearly her motives, nor to realize that her vision was unselfish. In fairy tales, we often find the trials of a figure who must remain silent for the work to be complete. And one of my favorites is The 12 Swans, where the young princess has to redeem her 12 princely brothers from their swan forms by remaining silent for 7 years and weaving with her bare hands nettles. And she had to weave nettles that she gathered herself and crush them with her hands and then make a little coat. And it would take her 7 years to do the 12 coats. And in the meantime, of course, they did everything they could to accuse her of witchcraft. And she was on the burning pyre when the 7th year was over, and she had the 12 coats with her. One was incomplete, it lacked a sleeve, and one brother remained with a swan's arm. But at the last minute, the 12 swans flew in around the funeral pyre, and she threw the coats over them, and then she yelled out, "At last I can speak." And she told about the wicked stepmother who had entranced them and stolen her power. But this is what we're talking about, that kind of courage that allows you to become convicted, i.e., I am convicted. You might, in fact, be convicted, but you aren't defensive. It's the kind of courage that takes you out into a path of action. There is a point where everyone knows something needs to be done. And when you know that, and if there's enough will, it carries you out the front door and toward that goal. Now, if you're an artist and you're trying to do new work, you have got to be able to do this kind of double vision that you're doing right now, because we often can't take time to run and do a complete painting or a complete poem. But you don't want to miss that impulse. So you've got to jot it down in enough detail so that you don't lose the idea. One of the problems I have with people who are blocked is that they think they're dead, their ideas are gone. And in fact, really, they're all there. You just have to come to a place of listening. And so this is part of the silence that's required, that is courageous. To not talk about an idea, get it down. Don't spill your ideas. Don't give your ideas away, i.e. to something else that's going on at the moment or to another living person. Hold them in silence. And then as soon as you get home, if you're at work, do something with it. And you've got to have the courage to do it now, not wait till after supper when you're full and you can't. So this is where the courage comes in for no matter what your work is, because all of us have people in our life who are not going to understand why you're not fixing supper or why you can't go to the movies or why you are holed up in your house for 3 weeks or whatever it is that is your process. So the courage can come on very subtle form. Or the courage can be to start the Mothers of Ireland Club and agitate in the street. I mean, you have to know what your will wants, and it may be a very quiet project, but when we talk about the will, it's a project. Project. The third element is pity, or charity, or generosity, or love, or wanting to give. And this is the beautiful Empress card. She has a phoenix and a swan. She is a cornucopia. This is the queen. The third element, pity, was a requirement of the heroic knight of the Middle Ages. In the Inquisition of Joan of Arc, she told her examiners that it was the angel Michael who appeared to her and first told her of the pity that reigned in the Kingdom of France. Joan was moved by pity to remove the pitiable blight the English King Edward III, who had claimed the throne of France. Yeats wrote, "Above all, it was her, Maud's, indomitable pity that would lead her, matched only by the pitiful conditions of Ireland." As we recall, when Maud saw her first eviction, and a woman lay dying in the road, she returned to Dublin and she told her father, "I could not bear it. Someday I will change all that." And it was this outpouring of pity or love that fueled her. Yes?
What's the difference between pity and love?
It's the same. Kuan Yin people would use compassion, the bodhisattva of compassion. It's a more Christian term, pity, but it's also a very medieval term. There are so many beautiful medieval art songs about pity. And Piata is exactly that. That is pity.
There's a sorrow in this love.
Yes.
The suffering component.
and you saw Maud's face. That is what Kuan Yin was, remember? She is the Bodhisattva of compassion who always has one tear on her cheek. And she has 72 weapons, by the way, so this is not an ordinary Bodhisattva. And when she talks about weapons, we're talking about everything from commanding the wind to riding the hurricanes to arriving on a tempest. She had a sword that could cut and you wouldn't even know it. She had everlasting water. I mean, this woman was well equipped. But she also had one tear, which those people who believe they are followers of Kuan Yin, they have, through pity, compassion, vowed to be on the planet incarnate until the last incarnate being has been enlightened. Now that's pity. In Celtic mythologies, it's often Bridget, who is both the goddess of warriors and of poetry, who carries the pity. In Kabbalistic rites, the pity, believe it or not, is carried by the fifth Sephiroth, Geburah. Geburah is a very chaotic Sephiroth, and the requirement for that initiation is to view all and not judge or interfere. So again, the compassion has to be there to be with the pitiful ones. So this is not a bad term in... I think we've reduced it to in such limited use. But in its largest sense from the medieval times, piata is exactly the right image. It was very upsetting to the world when the face of Michelangelo's piata was smashed. And when I was at the Vatican in 84, I mean, they have that so protected now. I mean, if you even got close to it, I think you'd be dead. But it's behind glass and guarded heavily. And they couldn't quite repair her beautiful nose. So why we would want to smash the face of this beautiful pity, I don't know. But you see what the English did with Maud's image. They called her, mad gone. They called her whipping the women up into hysterical harpies. But it was her pity, the mother, that led the mothers into the street to begin fighting for Ireland. Because she's doing it in India. If she were doing it in the United States, we'd probably cut off her funds. I mean, she's doing it in India, where I think they still understand pity. Maud was very involved, yeah. Right. They thought she was sexual. In fact, she was not. Yeah, she was really very nun-like. So who you are also requires a certain silence to do great work. You have to become very secure in that heart center. The fourth part is, to me, the most beautiful card of the tarot, which is the hermit card, and that's the humility. This is, in all tarot traditions, the sexual card. It has to do with the binding of energy to the higher forces forever. It's a marriage of energies, a dedication of all of one's energy to a higher purpose. The lover's card is a balancing card. It's an equality of the two poles of the universe. This is a binding of oneself to the higher energies, and it is considered a Kundalini card. Hermit. And this one's very beautiful. This is called the Way Shower, the Light.
The Hermit.
Yes.
Didn't you say last night that mine is also called the Green?
The Green Woman.
The Green Woman.
The Rose. The Woman of the She.
There was a man I knew who talked about a guide. He's called the Green Man.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that was, I was wondering if the Green Woman was the same idea as being what you just described.
I think that's right, yeah.
We come
in the spring.
Right, and just kind of an odd moment and
yes.
Fades away and then disappears.
The woman that I'm working with on my Yeats work, my artist half, is she dreams about Yeats all the time, and she was so excited because one day she called up and she says, "You know, he came in a dream." And I said, "And what was he like?" And she said, "Well, he was very beautiful. He was totally dressed in a green robe like a druid. And he came in and he said, 'All I need is a nap.'" And yeah, and so she took him to the guest room and tucked him in, and that was the dream. And but he was dressed in a green druid robe, and that was great. Humility for Maud, as we surmise, came because she could not talk about her midlife problems with John McBride. I think she became more aware even then in her early career that the sake of Ireland was indeed what led her life, and she could not jeopardize that. So this is what we mean by humility. It's like a complete surrender to the work. The ego steps aside and accepts the work that you have laid before you. And she wrote in her memoir, which was when she was 84, 85, she broke her hip, and it just didn't mend properly, so she was pretty housebound, and being who she was, it drove her nuts. And she wrote quite a bit of her memoirs during that time. And the title was Servant of the Queen. And we learn in this that she saw herself in a humble, almost anonymous way. She wrote this about her recollection of a vision she had after a relief mission to Galway. "Tired but glowing, I looked out of the window of the train at the dark bogland where now only the tiny lakes gleamed in the fading light. Then I saw a tall, beautiful woman with dark hair blowing on the wind, and I knew it was Kathleen Nehoulihan. She was crossing the bog towards the hills, springing from stone to stone over the treacherous surface, and the little white stones shone, marking a path behind her, then faded into the darkness. I heard a voice say, 'You are one of the little stones on which the feet of the queen have rested on the way to freedom.' The sadness of the night took hold of me, and I cried. It seemed so lonely to be one of those little stones left behind on the path. But being old and not triumphant, I know the blessedness of having been one of those little stones on the path to freedom." And that's humility. You can be as small as a stone, and you know you have been part of a great work. Rodin was a very similar energy in a different way, and he knew when he was 18 that he had a great work stretched before him. And he knew that about important work, one did not hurry. And in fact, before he died, barely 3 months before he died, were the gates of hell finally cast into plaster. He never saw the bronze work because it took him all of those years to put this work into its perspective. He was a channel for a certain aspect of teaching. And what he basically was teaching in the gates of hell was the difference between souls who die aware and souls who die unaware. And the descent side is the unaware side, and the ascent side is the aware side. And that was the key to the gates of hell, and it took him almost 50 years to render that. Stravinsky was another one who had a life work, but he didn't really begin it until he was 67. And he wrote his first, what he considered, Stravinsky-esque piece. And his work was just glory, glory, glory. And he wrote nothing but glory music. He was a liturgist in his final days. And he converted to Catholicism from... Oh, there are so many things. After 67, I can't think of them now, their words go, but he wanted a proper setting for his music, and the Orthodox Church does not allow human voices, and so Stravinsky became a Catholic so that he could have both instruments and human voices. Well, they wouldn't allow instruments and only voices, whereas the Catholic Church allowed instruments. And Stravinsky's greatest pieces were presented to Pius in the Vatican and in St. Peter's, and he was very happy. So you have to find your work and then give to it and be the paintbrush or the pen or the arm or the stone. Maud was a stone, and she took the initiation of the stone. And in the tarot card, this is the Ace of Discs. Yeats was the sword, and it was his job to cut away all illusion and delusion and to set forth a history. Both of them were the cup, and this is perfect reception. The stone. What?
Why did you say that she was the stone?
She took the initiation of the stone. She considered, she was a pebble on that path, and the stones are the foundation.
So the humility is in that you are the palm of the ear.
That's right. That's right.
Both courage to realize you are part and to abate the fear of the fact you
right.
are.
Just a small
part. You have to have the whole picture.
That's right.
In order to feel the vibrance.
Right. Exactly. She had to know about the queen and then allow the queen to step upon her. That's how I see it. Yeats had to know about the wisdom of the other world and then become the arm to ride it. Initiation to a Celt. This is about poetry, prophecy, knowing. And we all are in the cauldron. Every single one of us has our own inner knowing, if you would but listen. which Jung said is an instinct. Jung said that creativity is an instinct. All of us have that impulse to create out of ourselves, whether it's a baby or a poem. And you can begin to understand why the Celts held the women in such esteem, because they could create out of their bodies. And they didn't hate them for it, and they contracted with them for it. It was with great respect. The cauldron is reception, and it has to do with a gift everyone carries. It has to do with poetry, prophecy, knowing, and it is about containment. So it's a way of seeing yourself as part of that great whole. It's also in Celtic terms called the living rose. Each of us comes from the living rose, which Yeats saw as a fiery rose in the heavens. And out of that rose, each of us is but a smaller rose. So this is the Anima Mundi, a great fiery rose. So this is the will, or creativity, or pure energy. I want to find one more card, and then you can go on a break. Look for the devil. The devil card, remember in the play where Yeats has Kathleen, I found it, bargain with the devil for the souls of the people of Ireland? This enraged the Catholic Church, because I think this is where we part ways from universal knowledge. He did not have any impulse in him to do black magic. This was not about black magic. But what Hermetic tradition, and particularly Tarot tradition, consider to be the test on the physical plane is to release oneself from the bondage of the illusion of the ego. And that is represented by the devil card. And whenever you pull the devil card in a reading, it is an opportunity for you to free yourself. This is a freedom card. Or it's an enslavement card if you choose to keep the chains around you. And so what Yeats was saying in the play was, it is so important for that living creativity and impulse to live that I am willing to barter for the souls of the people of Ireland, knowing that you can win. When Maud was doing the hunger strike, she was bartering with the devil. And when she was in jail, she immediately, the second time, went on a hunger strike, and she was very happy. And the prison doctor would come and examine the fasting prisoners to see what condition they were in, and he called her the most cheerful faster he had ever met. And he asked her what that was about. And she said, "You don't get it. If I die, or if I live, I still win." She said, "If I die, all hell will break loose. But if I win, all hell will break loose." So one way or the other, she knew that this was in her favor. This is a very phallic devil. You'll see it when I pass it around. But it has, in Crowley's terms, you can either chain your energy to the physical plane and literally to the penis, or you can raise the energy and free yourself from the illusion of the physical plane and raise your, what would we say, raise your intention, the right use of action. Yes, and if you get stuck there, this is the trick in Jungian psychology as well. It's like, so what's wrong with the ego? Well, nothing. But Jung would say individuation is an opportunity to be aware or conscious of what you're doing. Yeats himself said at the end of his life, magic is not standing in circles, waving your arms, and muttering incantations. It's living life fully. So it's about living life only with full energy and full awareness. You could say that Maud made a grave mistake in the marriage to MacBride because she did it with a decision, an egoic decision, where she really did not consider who the man was or whether he was capable of carrying the archetype that she placed upon him. That is a big mistake. That was without awareness. And so the physical marriage was what he expected. And what she wanted from him was a political vehicle. And he wasn't up to it. So she married without awareness. And we could say that that is, that's a physical thing. She didn't see past the persona of this man. Yes, her paddle shadow, right.
Did she also marry in a way without money?
Well, I think she thought she had discussed it. But you know how life is. People hear exactly what they want to hear. He heard yes. He didn't hear the contract. And she heard yes. And that's all we can say. I mean, we hear exactly what we want to hear until we hear something else. So. Okay, take a break and we'll go on. Differences, you could say, between hermetic ideas and well, any theory that this is the only life, or that this is all you get, this is all there is. The hermetic traditions believe that we are here on an evolutionary path, and that each life contributes to the overall perfection, you could say, of a soul essence that is trying to become its part of that great world soul. As above, so below is one way of putting it. All of us together form part of that great soul. And when all of our energies are gathered back into the great energy, each of us will become a part of it. But if one of us has not done the impulse that you were meant to be, we're cheated of your spark. So the pebble is, you could say, insignificant, but it is more important than you know, because every pebble is different, every stone is different, every poet is different, every artist is different. And so the purpose of the physical plane is in part to help you, as Jung would say, individuate, or as Yeats would say, to become your essential self. And incarnation in this tradition has to do with coming here for a specific love or purpose that you are going to attempt to develop in this life. And every life is different. You come here to do different things every life. But all of it adds up. I mean, and this is where there is a large, specific energy that you have, that your impulse is, and you have to find it. So part of your job while you're here is to attempt to get a glimpse of your essence. The Sufi poet Kabir had a beautiful poem in which he was talking about the great swing between the stars and the moon. And it's like in a moment he glimpsed that whole universe with all its parts and its motion. And he said, having glimpsed it for a moment, I became its servant for life. So glimpsing your motion or glimpsing your essence will make you a servant of the queen or a servant for life. And so the purpose of physical life is important. It is not nothing. But discerning what of the physical life is part of your impulse is the task. So we are all here to learn discernment. And only you, and this is where the courage comes in, can know what is right for you. Each of you must be your own channel. Each of you must become your own teacher. Because only you know the solution to a particular problem. So that is the purpose of physical life, is to lead us not into temptation and deliver us from evil. Because there are temptations and tests and trials and dragons to slay. Yes. And you must know which is the right dragon. In the old days of assertiveness training, I was one of those. I taught them how. And one of my favorite groups was a group of nuns I worked with, the Sisters of Loretta. And they had the old nuns still in the habits and the young nuns who were wearing street clothes. And I was called in 1972 they were having a fight in the house and they needed a mediator, and I went. And what they were fighting about was that the old nuns did not think it was appropriate for the young nuns to date. Times were changing in the church. And I was stunned. I was not sure what to do with this. They weren't sleeping with him, mind you. They were just dating. So you have to know what's right for you. That's what I came to in the workshop. You know, I said, I think you're all very strong if you can tempt the devil and know what you're up to. And well, they needed experience. They needed experience of the world. And I'm sure that there were many who would fall by the wayside. As you know, from 75 on, nuns and priests left the priesthood and the convents in great numbers because they had been dating. But it was right for them. It was right for them. And I think it will lead the church in a new direction, or the church will fail. And things that can't grow and change with the times are meant to fail. Some friends of mine asked once, you know, what I had to do with the Catholic Church after all these years. And I said, well, I'm a Catholic in waiting. And they said, what? And I said, waiting for the right pope and waiting for women to be priests. And I have this vision that when I'm about 80, they will relent. And I will go and enter some seminary and become a bishop by the age of 90. You know? Because I think it should be done. But so the physical plane is important. And when we are here, it's very hard to glimpse the other world. And so learning to do this kind of double vision, where you are attending to your impulse and also being with what is going on around you, is a discipline which I think will pay off. Hundreds of ideas come when you're just sitting and listening. And you don't need to listen in rapt attention or copy down every word. The self hears what it is meant to hear. The ego hears what it wants to hear. The self hears what it is meant to hear. So I would like now to... we have to make a decision here. We've got far too many people to do dream drama, psychodrama, unless we hold it for afternoon and simply give over to it and watch people work. And that's a condition that would, if we took the whole afternoon, 2 hours, we could probably do 3 sets of work. Or we can stay in the group and hear each other's desires, what you're struggling with. Or we can work in small groups and get more, you know, you won't know as many people, but you would get more discussion of your own particular problems and issues. So I guess I'd like to see what you want to do. Dream drama is a form of psychodrama that I developed to help people work with. My feeling is that right information and right action comes in our dreams and in our twilight sleeps and out the right side or the left side of your head, through my left ear, through people's peripheral vision, whatever. And sometimes it's fun to see an action in the room that you have dreamt about but probably don't have the courage to carry out into the world. So what I like to do is start with the telling of the dream, and then we pick people to play the parts of the dream, and you are in control. You simply tell them what their lines are, and you are both the director and in the place of the ego in the dream. And it's kind of fun. Would you like to do that? Well, it's fun, and we could do. We could set the clock, and we could do 4 sets, and we could divide into 4 groups, and you could have 15 minutes to prepare one woman's dream, and then we could have performances, like a theater. We could do it that way. Would you like to do that? No? the other options is to sit in a large circle like this and have one person prepare the group and do it out in the middle here. But we can get more mileage out of 4 dreams and 4 groups and then doing a theater performance. Or we can stay in the group. Yeah. Eventually you'd all be watching. But the prep time would be, yeah. Or we can do one of some very brave person and continue with discussion. I mean, come on, be brave. You had a doozy. So you're ready to work. See, we got a volunteer. Okay. All right. Between now and lunch, I would like to hear you struggle with will, courage, pity, humility. Tell your stories. We are Celts today. We're going to tell stories, tell dreams. Tell stories. Tell me a story. Tell me your reactions to Maud. Tell me your reactions to Kuan Yin. Tell me your reactions to Lady Teresa, whatever you like. We don't have to do it. You would like to experience? We can do a meditation and we can get right there. Walk like her. Well, stand up right now, Susan. Yes. I would like to see you. Start with the garden and that old dog. That's an easy place to start. That's all right. She's in her heels, but she was standing in the garden. Walk like an old woman. I mean, it's easiest to get into the old woman of Ireland. Well, she who speaks up gets chosen. But she's a pretty fiery old lady, so maybe you want to start where she's 28 and standing there like this. That's right. How would a woman like that walk? Mm-hmm. Yep, she did that. Yeah. Yeah, she got very old. She absolutely loved that old dog. It was for Time Life. She must have been dressed up for Time Life because I think it was a house slipper woman. She did that a lot. She was a chain smoker. You got it. with a touch of consumption, whatever that is. But she was the stone, so she let herself be walked upon by the queen. But can you imagine what it's like to go around the world as a stone? Yeah. Because there was work to be done. And yet, the question we could ask is, do you really think she was connected to an impulse? I mean, it's fair to ask that question. I've thought a lot about that, and well, she had in her, I think that the stone had to do with her humility, her willingness to bring that fire into action. She was not a grounded person in the ordinary sense. She was very, very disciplined. This woman had a very long day, day after day. Her writing occupied her. Her meetings, her thinking occupied her. Her children, her animals were her grounding. But Ireland grounded her. So in that sense, she accepted the stone, the grounding in her work. I think you have to look at her as an ambivert. Equally introverted and extroverted. She had very extroverted periods of her life, followed by equally introverted retreats for longer periods of time than the extroversion. So if she was speaking or working in Ireland, this would be several months. But she would be back in retreat several months, and often ill. She never let people know that the contact with people made her ill. and exhausted her. That's not an extrovert. But she had terrible stage fright. When what people began to realize is that she shook like a leaf before she went on to her stage work, her rally work. And only when she was out on the street leading the mob did the stage fright go away. So she was not an easy extrovert. My feeling is typologically she's closer to an introvert because of the powerful clairvoyance, and she's feeling sensate. She required the presence of the object for her clairvoyance. And my analyst, David Hart, talked to me about the difference between introverted sensation and introverted intuition. And he said, it's very hard to tell the difference. He said, really the only difference is that the introverted sensate people need the presence of the object. Introverted intuitives do not. Yeats was much more introverted intuitive. Yes. Through the letters. Yeah. She needed the object. And she needed the reason she wanted to build literally the castle of heroes is that she always needed the embodiment of the object, or his presence or a letter. Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
I think with the workshop.
Tell me.
I was traveling and traveling to the bar, fighting. And while I'm writing the screen down, I noticed that the things out of my head, they're losing the time out, and I cannot even see what I'm writing. So I'm trying to find another pen. And then I look at the clock, and it's 1 second. And that was the end.
That was the end of the dream.
Yeah, and then I had really early in the morning, so I knew I was going to work.
Well, what was the struggle to survive be?
What did we mean?
Yes, because it would imply to me there's some sense of needing to state your identity, it to be like, to be accepted or to be involved with a group.
I've done for a long time, and the work for an administrator, of course, which is very much similar. So the one and still hearing a lot of ideas.
Yeah.
So there is the top, not the five, but the kind of, you know, like wanting to be out there and know that I cannot burst out, that I can, it's almost like the quiet, you know, the inward, and the quiet,
right.
You
want to say who you are.
Yes.
Well, tell me who you are. Say, I am a woman who...
I am a woman who was locked up in a hollow tree for many years. Lived in a forest with animals.
I intend to get out of the hollow. Can you welcome her to this group, the woman from the hollow tree? Give her a greeting. Someone greet her.
I'm very hard for me to perceive.
That's right.
You know, it's just like I always want to hide, and I still want to be there. You know?
Yes, like but now you're struggling to be in a group. And wonderful thing about the Celts is that we are all trees. Each of us is a different tree according to our nature. There's a beautiful Celtic oracle called the Tree Oracle, and it's a beautiful set of cards. And all of the trees are there. Ah, they can look at it. Yeah. Maud and I be oak. That's you can look and pass it around because
you know how beautiful you look.
That's very important. I have the courage to share my dream.
I have the courage to share my dream in a group. I do share.
Yes, but in a group. Yeah. Thank you. Well, it is about the dance, and one of Yeats's great poems is called The Dance of the Golden King and the Silver Lady, and in it he is giving the image of the two pillars of the universe as great king and lady, and gyring and circling and dancing on the top of the tower, and it's that golden king and his wild lady. And so we would miss the dance if we didn't come to the physical plane. And we would also miss the pain. But it's here that the emotions have more importance, perhaps, than we know. It's through the emotions that we have a sense of value. And it's through values that we are led to right action. I don't think you can think about right action. I think you have to feel about right action. And you have to accept the hard knocks, just like Maud did. And you have to be willing to take the criticism, and you have to be willing to look at yourself and say, ouch, that was really a dumb thing I did. And you take the consequences. So the dance is what it's about. Anybody else? Keep going. Come on, ladies. This is... And how would that look to be a swimmer of life? So the things of the outer world or other people's agendas would not pull you out of... Okay. And what about the part where you could say to the analyst, this is not what I want? And you could say that. And how did that feel? Okay. So it's more being centered in the process. A channel swimmer. The long-distance swimmer. A long-distance swimmer.
A woman of both worlds.
A woman of both worlds.
Yeah.
The other implication is, if you are the cup or the water, and you're led by pity or charity, how could you become more and more of the cup, or more in the cup? Yes, it's the cauldron. Of that. Sometimes when we're in analysis, what we learn is to accept our type. We get trained out of our type in a lot of experiences in schools or graduate schools or jobs. The implication here might be that the analyst is not of your type. And to meet that agenda pulls you out of type. And when we're out of type, we do fret, and we do feel out of sorts. But to stay in type, in that rhythm, you have, first of all, to accept your type. So a more intuitive way, or a more